The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Oh. Today I'm going to pick up on a theme I started last week in this reflection, which is the views in our mind, heart, especially our minds. And I guess a little bit of this series is how they come to be, how they contribute to conflict or quarrels. And I talked about it more from an interpersonal perspective, mostly last week, and the perspective of compassion. And today I'm going to kind of pick up on the story and talk about it a little bit more through a wisdom lens. So to recap, last time, the Buddha is sitting with some of his monks, and this young pretentious man, Dandapani, stick in hand is the literal translation of the name the suttas give him, comes sauntering up and tries to start an argument about views. And the Buddha doesn't have anything of it. And he makes an enigmatic statement, which I will paraphrase. He says, well, the challenge he receives is, what view do you proclaim, recluse? Like, really in a provocative way. And he responds very calmly, I proclaim my teaching in such a way that it does not quarrel with anyone in the world. With anyone in the world. And this perplexes and confounds and vexes his would-be opponent, who goes wandering off again, marching off again. And the monks later ask the Buddha for an explanation, and he gives an equally enigmatic explanation before retiring for the night, saying, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of proliferation beset one, if nothing is found to delight, welcome, or hold on to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to greed, aversion, views, doubt, conceit. This is the end of resorting to quarrels, brawls, disputes, malicious words. Basically, the end of violence. So it's all quite enigmatic, and the English is not so hospitable sometimes. So the Buddha goes off to bed, and the monks are perplexed. And they go to find an esteemed teacher, someone the Buddha spoke highly of, thought highly of, Mahakachana, for an answer. They want an unpacking. And a little bit about the background of this monk that they're going to, part of why he's so esteemed is that he was a multi-generational. He'd been born into the position of court chaplain for a very obnoxiously bad king. A really bad guy. And when the king heard the Buddha was somewhat nearby, he asked his court chaplain, who later became a monk, go find him and bring him to me so that I can hear his teachings. And this monk, this person's no fool, this chaplain's no fool. Well, sure, I can go do that, but you have to promise me you'll let me resign and become a monk with him afterwards. And so the king, rather desperate for the Buddha's company, agrees, and the chaplain goes off ordained, and the Buddha declines to come. And so this monk ends up living in the kingdom, kind of keeping a bit of a low profile. Eventually, this king, Ajatasattu, and the Buddha do meet, but the monk, Mahakachana, becomes revered for his clarity, for his deep practice and understanding of the roots of conflict. And I can only imagine that being in the court of a not very nice leader and having to tread carefully with all of those dynamics probably helped him develop some of this wisdom before he even started meditating. There's another story of him where he's meditating peacefully in his little hut off in the woods somewhere, and this group of boys comes and is taunting him and like marching around the hut and trampling grass and yelling and all that kind of thing. And so eventually he comes out and very peacefully gives them a little talking to. But in such a way that's designed to have their teacher come visit him. And then he and their teacher come to a kind of rapprochement and understanding. So he was quite skillful in dealing with the dynamics people have. He was also known for very detailed, systematic unpacking of the Buddha's most mysterious teachings. So all of this is kind of in the back of these students' minds, these meditators' minds, when they go to talk to him. He's the perfect guy to go to. And he gives an analysis of the underlying conflict. And I just want to mention here that the ancient teachings have a number of these kinds of analyses. And I'm going to talk about this in terms of a linear progression of conditionality. However, they're not necessarily linear. All of these different ways of approaching the underlying dynamics of our minds, our relationships, our hearts, they form more like a web or a matrix, even a mandala, you could say. And all of them underscore the tendency we humans have to get into conflict around opinions, views, entrenchment. So basically, Mahakachana first basically says, "Why are you coming to me? You had the Buddha." And they beg him, saying, "We didn't understand what the Buddha said." He's like, "Okay, here we go." Dependent on, and he's talking about our senses here, the presence of our eye and the forms that meet it, this bare recognition arises. And based on that contact, there is a feeling, good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant. And based on that feeling, one labels something in their minds. And what a person labels, they then think about, they objectify, they perseverate, and it becomes this kind of storm of proliferation that kind of take over our minds. And he repeats this for everything that comes in to our senses, eyes, ears, taste, smell, mind, all of it. So that's a little dry and it's real, right? What he's talking about is the interplay of how we feel about something at a very basic level. Do we like it or not like it? Is it pleasant or unpleasant? That then kind of, if it's not seen as such, tints or taints everything that happens afterwards. The act of perceiving something, of making even a categorization of it, is tinged by that. And that then leads to what kinds of thoughts we have, how much we think, perceptions and notions. Of papancha, proliferation, mental suffering, basically. Obsession is another word used for it, obsession. And not only that, any of this can have a feedback loop at any point in the chain. So my attitude about something or someone can inform whether or not I find what comes from them pleasant or unpleasant. All of you have experienced this. My attitude about or my view about something may even influence whether or not I see or perceive it at all, or how I take it in. There are studies done on this scientifically where a person can be primed to see something in their environment by subtle questions or even a document they read or something like that. And they'll notice that thing. They won't notice much else. Or they'll notice it in a certain way, with a certain attitude, without knowing much else. Advertisers know this well. So this cycle, we're always experiencing it. And as the Buddha and then this Mahakachana fellow are talking about, this the fixation based on this tends to drive conflicts, arguments, reified opinions, directions in life, big pronouncements about what's real or isn't, or what's valuable or isn't. So, what to do? The delusory power of this matrix can be short-circuited, interrupted at several points. The easiest is something that Maria talked about a few weeks ago, Vedana, or a feeling tone. Simply noticing something as pleasant or unpleasant can often just cut through a whole kind of maelstrom of thinking, opinions, anxiety, difficulty, fixation with. Like, oh, it's that simple. I'm hooked on this because it's pleasant in some way, or I'm hooked on it because it's unpleasant in some way. So that's the first place. The second place, in meditation, you can see the act of perceiving in action sometimes. Sanya is the Pali. And sanya is just a little beyond that bare conscious recognition I was talking about at the beginning, where I might just, or you might just perceive, oh, sound. Then a nanosecond after that, tweet. That's a perception. Or the image of bird comes up. That's also a perception. So seeing this can be really helpful because it's that perceptual level, that cognizing, that's often where the delusion starts to creep in. The opinion about feeling. Pleasant or unpleasant? Oh, what an obnoxious tweet. Whatever. What an obnoxious sound. I don't know if any of you have had this experience, but sometimes I'll mishear something and the Vedana of it will change based on what I thought it was. Right? So it might be very different if I think it's a bird versus a cell phone, for example. So, seeing that can sometimes kind of undercut the tendency for us to weave those slightly valenced opinions of what we perceive into the view. Oh, there shouldn't be cell phones here, or less likely, there shouldn't be birds here. That's possible. If it's in your house, maybe there shouldn't. So, that's the second spot. Watching the weaving of perception into view and into proliferation, papancha, because it's a slippery slope. One starts to lead to the other quite quickly. And you're nodding. I know a number of you have seen this at different points, glimpsed it. So the third level, the deepest level, is the view of the self as the center of things, self-view, underlying permanent, fixed, immutable self as a belief, as a perception. And this, of course, doesn't mean we don't have a conventional self. The Buddha certainly did. He wandered around India teaching for 45 years after he woke up. But this self as the main operator, the star of the show, the reference by which everything else is seen, that tends to give a lot more power to a fixed opinion than this idea that, oh, I'm conditioned by my culture, by my upbringing, by my education, by my social location, by keep going, by biology. So the underlying essentialist view of oneself tends to pull up, make more concrete a fixed notion of rightness or wrongness based on the comparison with ourselves. And perhaps more perniciously, that underlying essentialist view applies to others. Oh, they are like this. They are that way. This kind of person is that way. This categorization, another word for papancha, proliferation, is objectification. It's that fixity in the mind regarding identity view, mine, yours, anyone's, that tends to lead to a greater certainty about where we stand and about who they are and where they stand. So I have a story about this. Some years ago, I was living in Berkeley for graduate school, and I would swim regularly, almost every day, probably. And one time I went to the pool, and it was, I can't remember the exact circumstances, but it was maybe starting to fill up, but there were one or two lanes empty. I chose a lane and started swimming. And as I was, this guy, even though there was an empty lane, got into my lane and vibed me with such hostility. And even, I think, said something mean and obnoxious to get me to move that, I was just like, for you, in back in my mind, just not in a happy place about this guy. And as I'm getting up, I did yield and move to another lane. He happened to like move his arm, and I saw a concentration camp tattoo on his arm. And immediately, boom, something fell away from me. Oh, this person is carrying so much pain. So much pain. So it shifted the reaction from who the heck are you to compassion. I didn't say anything to him. I just politely left and moved. But that reification of this man as a jerk shifted to, oh, this is another suffering being. Look at the condition, one little condition in his life that I had a view of. Who knows what the heck else happened? But one little glimpse could shift the whole thing. So I'm pointing to this because one alternative to this self view that underlies so many kinds of concretized attitudes, potential for conflict, is to start to see things in terms of the wisdom lens, conditionality. That someone else's behavior, no matter how irritating, vexing, perplexing, may be conditioned by all of these forces that none of us can see. Everyone is more complex than they present at face value. Everyone has a story. Everyone has a background. And to begin to see the background, even sense into all of the myriad conditions that make us form and make others form, opens the doorway to a broader view, and it opens the doorway to loop back to yes, last week's talk to compassion, to dropping underneath. It doesn't mean necessarily being a doormat, but it can bring a different way of responding in. So it can inspire a different level of wise action. So thank you for your kind attention. That little talk. Thank you all very much for your questions, your silent presence, your practice. May all beings everywhere benefit from our practice here together. May our own lives, minds, and hearts develop greater capacity for awareness, wisdom, and peace. And may those benefits ripple outwards and outwards. Thank you for the sincerity of your practice.